Okay, this is session 26. It's January 8th, 2007. Elvis Presley's 72nd birthday. And we're in William Irwin Thompson's section of the book. And this is side one. And we're just going to review the last quote we were doing last session. I'm going to run through it, get us in the mood, and then we're going to go to a new quote that follows from that. And Scott will read that. But let me just review the first quote, which we think we didn't finish. We didn't get to finish my quick run-through of it in the last session. So this is from an essay called A Guy in Politics, written by William Irwin Thompson for the Whole Earth Review, issue number 53, winter 1986-87 edition. Okay, here we go. If one takes all of the five future transforms together, they form a pattern, a slight Aikido move that is necessary to transform the militarism of Reagan into a new populist liberalism for a transformed Democratic Party in the 90s. If the Democratic Party remains the party of the industrial past, of labor unions and ethnic blocs, it will, like Mondale, become a fossil. And if the Democratic Party tries to become identical to Reagan's party and to woo the same constituency, it will only prove itself to be shallow, thoughtless, opportunistic, and completely lacking in credibility as well as power. If, on the other hand, a new American ecological party were to try to make it on its own, such a movement on the left would generate its mirror opposite on the far right, and Lyndon LaRouche's thermonuclear fusionists would probably match the Greens vote for vote, with each party taking about 15% of the electorate. It would be far better for the Democratic Party to take the best of the Ecological Party and the best of American big science to move the new ethnic majority in defeat of the white suburban affluent constituency that supports Reagan. Paradoxically, it is this new Latin and Asian America that is more truly expressive of the California culture that first put Reagan into power. I doubt if the Democratic Party will adopt Guy in Politics in 1988. Most likely, it will try to copy the Republicans with someone like Iacocca, and our politics will be the typical American cultural situation of Avis and Hertz, Pepsi and Coca-Cola, McDonald's and Burger King. But history is full of surprises like Chernobyl, so I would imagine that by 1992, this awful generation of the 50s, these hideous reruns of the anti-intellectual McCarthy era, will have spent themselves. Just as the 60s introduced a quantum leap in consciousness for the whole human race, so will the 90s take us up one more step. It won't take a national charismatic leader to effect such a cultural shift, for by the 90s, the generation of the 60s will be spread throughout the establishment as corporate presidents, as politicians, as popular musicians and video artists, as university leaders. As they look around and see themselves in position, they will remember. And those camp followers who now celebrate their neoconservative orthodoxy will change spots and drag out their old 60s credentials and begin to boast about how many demonstrations, love-ins, and rock festivals they took part in. Once again, it will be fashionable to be idealistic and patriotic, not simply for Springsteen's USA, but the entire planet. Such is the fantasy of one who came of age in the 60s, and such is my fantasy of a new guy in form of politics for the 90s. So that was Thompson's thinking in the middle 80s. We spent a long time discussing that quote and digressing on a lot of issues last session, and let's move on to the next quote.
We sort of came to the conclusion that he was... He was off in his predictions.
Yes, and that he was missing the dynamics coming in with the digital 90s media.
Mm-hmm.
He had no inkling of what was coming down the pike.
Mm-hmm.
The next quote is from an article written for The Quest, which I think is a theosophical magazine, a Theosophical Society, Volume 4, Number 1, Spring 1991. The essay is called Culture, Chaos, and Planetary Transformation. Now, with this idea of chaos, he may be beginning to see that it wasn't so cut and dried as he spelled out in the quote we just did. Let's see what he tries to say. So, Scott, this is bottom of page 63, the top of page 65 of my book. So you're going to read it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So the loss of American hegemony is one thing, but there's another quality coming on at the same time. It does like it's sort of a return of the Middle Ages, in the sense that nationalism is not as important as it used to be, but class, in the Marxist sense, has not gone away. In many ways, one's access to education, whether one goes to Harvard or not, seems to be now a function of family. and the society is beginning to take on very medieval characteristics. There's a ruling class at the top that communicates through oral means, face to face. Then there's scientific slash technical class, which would be like the, quote, informational knights, unquote. These are the equivalents of the lords and knights of the Middle Ages, and they communicate through electronic, scientific, and technical means. And then there's a kind of artisanal class at the bottom. And at the bottom, there's an underclass.
So there's a kind of artisanal class, and at the bottom, there's an underclass.
Right. So it's almost like a return of the Vedic fourfold caste system, mouth, eye, hand, and rump. The oral class has the right to assent.
No, has the right accent.
The right accent, and has wealth. The class of the eye reads and studies, and has science and art. The class of the hand works, and the bottom is on its ass. So things are becoming extremely hierarchical as the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and the smaller ruling class just rules the masses through pageantry and illusion. So TV is the means of disseminating and creating this electronic state of entertainment. But the people who are outside are, by definition, not part of the, quote, electro-peasantry. Television really is the means that defines whether you are a knight of information or an electro-peasant.
Yeah, he says other places that the people that are the content of television, that come from the oral class, don't really engage in the television culture.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I don't know if that's an upcoming quote. I don't know. I remember him saying that.
Is he understanding the dynamics of the beginning to understand the dynamics of the TV body here?
No, I think that what he's describing here is more the world that McLuhan discussed in the '50s and sixties. McLuhan discussed the retrieval of the medieval world. And the caveman world, he said advertising was the cave art of the suburban TV world. He's probably a bit behind in his media analysis because he's now beginning to focus more on it, because he was thinking in terms of finding and retrieving the energies of first nature in the 70s. He was basically a dropout, and he got involved with Findhorn and their special energies in growing their plants, and we'll call astrobody work. So you're seeing through the 80s and 90s is the media seems to become what McLuhan would call elephantiasis, you know, huge as a figure. Actually, the media was shrinking in terms of the average person's ability to interact with it, but the mass media was becoming gargantuan as it faded out, like a supernova as it dies, is most colorful at the end. So you have that glamorous, glossy media period of the 80s, early 90s. He can't avoid that, and so he's analyzing it, and he's seeing this. He's sort of timidly saying, well, it looks like the Middle Ages. He doesn't see, as McLuhan saw, that it was not only the Middle Ages. It was the time of ancient Greece and Rome. It was the time of Mesopotamian slave societies, the time of caveman, time of the future, science fiction, Star Trek reality. All these realities had arrived in the global theater. So that's a broader view of the informational society than Thompson is dealing with. So Thompson's adjusting to his humanist, almost industrial metaphors, and a correction of the pollution of the industrial phase, and adapting out of that to the new concerns with media. As we'll see by the end of the 90s, he's saying, we've got to start really understanding McLuhan. And he starts talking almost like a media ecologist. But this is an example of the transition where he's talking about media environment effects, but it's well into the 80s. Oh, this is 1991. So I don't know if it's clear, but he's seeing the Middle Ages coming back as a meme, the kind of social structure that was arriving in the West or in North America that reminded him of a medieval structure. And he makes interesting metaphors here, or models, like the idea of the mouth, eye, hand, and rump.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good.
Was the Middle Ages before the Renaissance?
Yes. Yeah.
That was a period. But it was after the Dark Ages.
Yes.
So we were coming out of the Dark Ages, where nobody. Well, so what characterized the Middle Ages as distinct from the Dark Ages and the Renaissance?
Well, if you look at forget his name, the guy did the book, The Alphabet and The Alphabet
Richard
and the Gods.
Schlain.
Schlain, right. Was it Leonard Schlain?
Leonard Schlain.
Yeah.
Alphabet
he talks
the
about the rise of visual technologies start coming back in with the monasteries around 1000 A.D. and the beginning of crafts and the spin-off from the beginning universities and the monasteries, and eventually paper coming in from China. The medieval period is the retrieval of a bit more visual space that happened in Rome, and it's balanced off by the acoustic resonance coming out of the Dark Ages. So it's like McLuhan would say it's a balanced period, and it was a glorious period of the cathedrals, Chartres cathedrals, and
we get the illuminated manuscripts.
Well, that happened in the Dark Ages, and then it continues into the Middle Ages. But you have the influx of science and algebra from the Muslim culture, and they were more advanced than the Western Europe coming out of the Dark Ages. So the mixture of the Near East culture and the Western European culture was the Renaissance of that period.
Synergy of memes.
Yeah. And it's a synergy of different technological phases meeting. So that was what McLuhan called the dangerous hybrids, the hybrid energies of two cultures mixing and affecting each other. And out of that abrasion comes something new. So the new was this new kind of eye culture, which was going to lead to the printing press. So that's the Middle Ages.
Why does he call it the danger of cultures coming together?
McLuhan. Oh, because it's going to shake up both cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Usually in history it was a civilized culture mixing up with a barbarian culture, civilized being technically a culture with writing, meeting a culture that didn't have writing. And those were the famous barbarian and empire clashes.
Mm-hmm.
So the interesting thing here, he has the mouth, the eye, the hand, and the rump. Now the hand, most people think, is kinetic. It is tactile in McLuhan terms, but he's missing the tactile interplay. And I think it's Thompson's inability to see the actual tactile nature of the 20th century that makes his media analysis rather wooden.
Mm.
And he falls back on talking about the grievances for class, that there is still a problem, as he says, class in a Marxist sense. There's a problem for the working class, the bottom, versus the rich, whereas neither rich nor poor can be categorized like that when they're in the software utopia that starts happening in the 50s and 60s with all the pre-pay TV, relatively free software environments of analog, one-way broadcast television, magazines, movies, and TV. What now appears to be a golden era for Americans' nostalgia, the 50s and 60s. I mean, and that was something that everybody could experience. So there was a wealth which later becomes digitized into the TV body, but back there it's a TV landscape, that the problems of defining the classes based on economic income and hours of hard labor is what that grievance the unions tried to build on, but it didn't work because the working class was too involved with the new advantages of the entertainment world. What was called the entertainment world, but was really just the beginning of the TV body being built, even though it was just a landscape at that point. The bodies don't come in until the digital comes over and shrinks those TV, radio, and computer landscapes so that they are appendages or like barnacles for our bodies. for our chemical body. You follow what I'm saying?
Mm, yeah.
So the problem of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer is an industrial grievance, but it's not seeing the real enemy, which is the egalitarian nature of broadcast media in terms of people being able to share a lot of new environments,
mm-hmm.
regardless of how much money you made.
Yeah, although there's the belief among many that information within the electronic environment is still censored from the top down.
Okay, well, that's what McLuhan called programming the environment. Now, I mean, that's what the Kennedy assassination was. They agreed not to say there was conspiracy so they wouldn't create a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
That's programming the news. That's censoring for larger social stability because it's so inflammatory if it came out that there was a conspiracy when that event is broadcast instantly to millions in a radio and TV simultaneous instant situation.
Mm-hmm.
Society wasn't used to the effects of that, and it was volatile, so the inside Big Brothers had to censor that. So that is a disservice of bringing in the software affluence of the analog media, is that society needs to be programmed, at least on what we call the information level. But as McLuhan said, the news stories were puny compared to the wealth that people got 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
No story really could hold water for very long. It was longer back then than it is now, but it still was a new, powerful situation for people. Humanity never experienced that. So if you're a journalist, you're going to be harboring the old 19th century value of freedom and access to information, all information for everybody, and not looking at the effects of it. That's a literate one-way view of information dissemination, that everybody has a right to read and have it and to know it. But that's okay in a literate environment, but when you get a simultaneous electric environment, there's too many conflicting structures. There's like an ecology between all the industries and environments that you can't put out volatile information that would just inflame and create social clashes on all levels. Now, in the 60s, as the satellite environment came in and you couldn't control the news leakage, as McLuhan said, government by news leak, as you could in the 30s, 40s, 50s, the turbulence really spread. And the 60s are known as a turbulent decade.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the satellite effect going around the TV body. No, the TV landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's not get... Anyways...
Did you hear about the UFO sighting over O'Hare Airport last week?
Yes, I did. But before, here's a thought. Thompson is talking about the electro-peasantry. What's interesting about Thompson is he does have the post-TV computer phase awareness, because the computer environment sort of starts to bring in the hierarchical possibilities for actual employment in scientific and technical levels. There's a bit of control there that certain people don't get to be in a scientific and technical class, but should everybody get into it, because you got to have some people do the hardware work, what he calls the just the working class. And one could say that there is racism in the access to the universities where you get to be a member of the scientific and technical class.
Well, there's a biological, I think there's a biological discrimination, because like Zappa said recently in an interview, I heard him saying, you know, not everybody's brain knows can do math, you know? Not everybody...
He used to say not everybody can be manager.
Right.
Yeah, and he said there are a lot of people going around thinking everybody should be a manager. So the...
He had opposition to the idea that advertising was trying to sort of market the same bullshit to everybody, but he thought everybody was unique, and he didn't like that idea. But it is true that some people are going to have a brain that thinks mathematically, and therefore they're going to be more they're going to be the scientists.
Yeah. Now that's the if I think of the television as a certain entertainment medium in the 40s, in the 50s and 60s, but once you start bringing the computer and digitizing, that leads to all kinds of new jobs in the archiving or processing of information.
Yeah, data processing, there's jobs for all kinds of people. You don't have to be a...
Yeah, we can call that processing literate, technical data. Whereas when you watched Ed Sullivan in the 50s and 60s, it wasn't literal and technical data, but the increasing ability of the computer environment to deal with that, that therefore there were jobs that related to industry being increased and taking over in society in the 70s and 80s, and that was another level of the information society, as opposed to the TV level of information society. I mean, of information as entertainment, right?
Yeah.
So Thompson coming in after McLuhan is looking at the effects of the computerized economy, and so there is a kind of sensibility here that McLuhan did talk about, but Thompson is wrestling with it more after McLuhan's gone in the late 80s and early 90s, the actual digital economy.
Uh-huh.
Whereas it wasn't as strong, it wasn't as huge environment, and as a cliche environment in McLuhan's time. Right? So there is something in Thompson that is addressing the effects of the post-TV computer world, which is the quadrant, the section he is in my chart, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, about the UFO...
Well, the thing I wanted to say about that is that, you know, I've had interest in the idea of the UFO for a long time. I've always thought it would be neat to see one. I think it would be neat. Probably, I've heard people that have pretty vivid experiences of seeing them as saying that it's almost life-changing in a way, because the impression it makes, you know, all the implications of actually seeing something like that. But when I heard the report that credible witnesses, trained so-called people who were trained observers, a lot of people saw this UFO over O'Hare Airport, it freaked me out a little bit. I thought, gee, that's strange. I don't know that I am ready to hear about this in the mass media. Yeah, I'm ready to see one personally. I'm ready to think about the implications of it. But am I ready to hear about this in the mass media? I don't know. It kind of spooked me out.
Okay, well, that means that as a coast-to-coast listener, you guys have a private special niche of appreciation of the UFO subculture. But you're going to have to deal with the identity crisis that's going to happen to you guys when everybody's dealing with it. It's not unique, and it's a mass environment. That's what you're actually feeling, the narrow-casting world of the digital experience in the media, which is our Bell Show.
Well, I began
translate it back to the TV body, which is the mass centralized phenomenon that's a holdover of the analog media, and that wipes out the uniqueness of your
It's not the uniqueness of it so much. It's more to do with the fact that actually I realized that this really could so upset the economic and social structures in place on the planet right now that
and social structures is what the TV body manages as a centralizing stability. So the you're thinking of that mass thing where it isn't a mass thing in a digital environment. So you're thinking...
See, I don't want the world to come apart at the seams, people running around shooting each other in the streets and...
You think that would happen?
Possibly. I mean, the conflict among people's beliefs, religious, scientific, and otherwise, would be totally have the rug pulled out from underneath all of that stability.
So your dis-ease at this phenomenon, as you said, gee, maybe we need to censor the news. Maybe we're going to have to keep this story, just like the JFK assassination, keep a lid on it.
Yeah.
You began to pick up the programmer sensibility, and that upset you because that conflicted with your own ideas of freedom of information.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Or it needs to be managed and leaked out in tiny bits that can be absorbed without destroying the fabric of the social structure in which we live.
Well, congratulations. Here in session 26, Scott Norris has finally grabbed on to a slight inkling of the quandary and dilemma of being a Tetra manager.
But But you see, why do tetrad managers care? I mean, aren't there rogue tetrad managers who would just as soon create chaos within society because they know that there are ways they can take advantage of that for their own greedy purposes?
You saw a lot in the.
What makes a tetrad manager so the mankind's savior?
Any tetrad manager that defects from tetrad management protocols usually is killed. And so there have been a lot of dead bodies over the years, but in 2006, leading up to the election this year, maybe it was in 2005, you had Richard Clark and these guys, National Security Advisors, a lot of tetrad managers going nuts and putting out books. Treasury Secretary O'Neill did it. Many others. They were just flooded on the market. All these books exposing Bush. Remember that?
Yeah.
And those are tetrad managers taking advantage of the decentralized information society and angry about what they saw was faulty tetrad management by Bush and going public. Whereas before, if you went public, wrote a book, you'd end up like Philip Agee in exile and maybe potentially killed. And there were many people who were killed. So you're asking why would a tetrad manager care? Because a tetrad manager kind of feels invested in the system. He's allied with the owners. And his wallet's allied with it, so he might want to protect it. The tetrad manager is the system.
Well, do you think the survival of the middle class is important to the survival of the tetrad manager?
Yeah, the tetrad manager needs an orchestration of all the different levels that Thompson is talking about. Mm-hmm. The mouth, eye, hand, and rump. If you think of tactility as the interplay of those four zones or four senses, that's the tactile position. The tetrad manager is tactile, and it wants to keep a relatively efficient, functioning global theater.
Mm-hmm.
That's what tetrad management's about, programming the environments.
But why is he self-elected to do that? I mean, drink martinis on the beach with a lot of pretty girls around him? What does he care? Why does he self-elect to do this job? If he's got enough money to be able to live happily ever after, why even bother taking on the job of managing global culture?
Well, you're managing your own system from the owner's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You're managing your own companies, and you want to keep them going and evolving and keeping in touch with whatever is coming down the pike in terms of where society goes. They want to be in position so they can have colonies on Mars.
Yeah.
Or on the moon. So
they do that, why? Because it's fun and interesting, or...?
No, it's human nature to feel the power fulcrum, to be at the center. I mean, you get lots of perks in that environment. You get to use a lot of media. You get to fly around and experience a lot of different parts of the globe and different environments with a relative little interference.
Yeah. Well, that does put you in a different class than, say, the welfare mom, who, yes, she gets to watch TV, but she's in a different class.
Yeah, different, I'd call it different technological mix. The tetrad manager can become exhausted and tired, as McLuhan used to satirize. He said the rich man today is just a harassed bureaucrat. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the tetrad manager is a harassed bureaucrat. But people, without getting into the psychologies of different people's needs and obsessions, people like to keep busy. And if they got a relatively prestige-laden, comfortable job that gives them upward mobility, they'll stick with it. But I think what happened is that by the 80s and 90s, society got, the Android meme started to just wreck the chemical body, because we're talking about the tetrad manager's chemical body. But as it got superseded by the TV and chip body, there was burnout all over the place. So when you get this phrase, electro-peasantry, I don't think McLuhan would have used a phrase like that. What did he call it? He called them the yokels, the electronic yokels, is what he called people in the 60s. The ones he considered the counterculture as a bunch of electronic yokels. Electro-peasantry is beginning to pick up the sense in the 80s and 90s of the chemical body being really marginalized and ghettoized, more than McLuhan saw that. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The chemical body had a an orgy of excess in the 50s and 60s of using all his senses. But then as it got marginalized in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it became tired and filled with chronic fatigue and hypoglycemia and immune deficiencies and allergies. Just couldn't keep up. And it's that sensibility that Thompson brings to media ecology that McLuhan doesn't really... That's after McLuhan's time. So let's look at the next quote. Unless there's more you want to say about this?
No,
pretty straightforward, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, the thought did occur. I mean, I just watched this documentary on Enron, and there was a little piece in there where they showed the relationship between father and son Bush and Ken Lay. Current President Bush almost brought Ken Lay in as Secretary of Energy. There was a relationship, I'll scratch your back, you scratch my back, relationship going on there, which I don't know to what degree, and the Bush administration was, like the Reagan administration, was into the deregulation of energy, which was Ken Lay's big thing. I don't know to what degree that implies that the Bushes were involved in the corruption of the fall of Enron through guilt by association, or if they didn't really know what Ken Lay was up to and therefore cannot be implicated as being guilty in the matter. But the conversation we're right now raises the question in my mind, well, are they operating on a higher level that's ultimately good for the stabilization of the planetary economic and planetary technosphere that I don't know about, or are they a bunch of gangsters, or what is going on?
Well, McLuhan said in the 60s that, maybe the early 70s, that the information environment makes anybody in the public eye look like an angel or a devil. No escaping it. That's almost a medieval sensibility, maybe even a primitive sensibility, Mesopotamian or something. So since you can appear either one extreme or the other, then within that effect, you got to look at the Bush's image. And it's a lot more complex than that, because the Bushes represent many environments that they were involved with through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the father and the son. And those environments have to be programmed, so anybody in that position would program the same way, because it's playing catch up with the technological rapidity. Humans trying to maintain some kind of social stability in these incredibly upsetting new environments. So McLuhan would not bring in value judgments to these people when he consulted them. The lower rung corporate presidents, lower rung tetrad managers, the corporate presidents, not intelligence agencies, so that he didn't bring in judgment, but he did want them to look at what they're doing, and he would maybe get frustrated that they didn't understand the complexities that they were frantically trying to handle. They didn't have a clear view of it. Maybe McLuhan understood that nobody could. He once said, no philosopher king could handle this thing. And the smartest philosopher king could handle this situation. That's why McLuhan said the only way around is to turn off the electric environment for a while. That's the only way. No human is going to be able to manage this. So that's his dilemma, trying to get these people to see the seriousness of the situation, and that the problem is they can't implement it if they saw the seriousness and urgency of it. So that's where McLuhan was left in the lurch, and Bush is left in the lurch too. They're stuck with this.
Mm-hmm.
They're stuck with managing something that is in a state of chaos.
Right.
So
Thompson's analysis.
Remember, that's the title of this quote. This paragraph comes from a title. Thompson calls it "Culture, Chaos, and Planetary Transformation."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what were we going to say?
Well, Thompson's analysis of power at the level of the Bushes sounds to me like it's not as sophisticated as McLuhan, because he wants to make people wrong and say, these are bad politics or good politics. And you're saying McLuhan was a level above that, where he wasn't even making those kinds of evaluations.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems McLuhan had a more complex understanding of how to deal with the ecology than Thompson's simple green kind of approach to first nature ecology.
Yeah.
Not looking at the media ecology. I just put together, let's see where I can find this. I put together a bunch of quotes for somebody. This is McLuhan describing the tetramanders. I don't know if all of them are in my book or in my essay on McLuhan. Someone asked me, in what terms did McLuhan describe the approach of the tetramanders? So I gave a bunch of quotes from McLuhan as a collage to show how to answer the question. Okay, the first one is from Understanding Media, came out in 1964, page 204 of the MIT edition, which came out in 1994. The quote reads, "When the electric speed is introduced into such a delegated and representational organization," that would be like a 19th century political or bureaucratic structure, "this obsolescent organization can only be made to function by a series of subterfuges and makeshifts. These strike some observers as base betrayals of the original aims and purposes of the established forms." Now, you get what he's saying there? The White House is naturally going to have to operate by subterfuges and makeshifts, and the journalists and those dedicated to 19th century values of the Constitution will find this a base betrayal of the aims and purposes of the established industrial forms. You get the point here?
Mm-hmm.
He said it can only be made to function by a series of subterfuges and makeshifts. That's the inkling of how the tetramanager has to lie. Remember, 1947, the National Security Act said that those in intelligence can lie to the American people because it's a global ecology. And another quote, this is from 1955. McLuhan said, "Politics have become musical. Music has become politics. Government has become entertainment, and vice versa," meaning entertainment has become government. "Commerce has become incantation and magical gesture. Science and magic have married each other. Technology and the arts meet and mingle." Then he says in 1980, well, it was written in the late 70s and published after he died in the Journal of Communication, summer 1981, quote, "Everyone will be involved in role-playing, including those few elitists who interpret and or manage large-scale data patterns and thus control the functions of a speed-of-light society." They manage the large-scale data patterns. They say whether there are UFOs or not.
Mm-hmm.
They tell you whether Kennedy was assassinated by a team or one lone nut. But everyone, regardless, is involved in role-playing. But those few elitists who interpret and manage and the large-scale data patterns and thus control the function of a speed-of-light society, even they are involved in role-playing. So that quote is in my essay on McLuhan. Another one is in my essay on McLuhan, and this is written in 1971 from an article of McLuhan titled, "The Hijacking of Cities, Nations, and Planets in the Age of Spaceship Earth." And here is his quote, "The hijacker of a plane does not presume to operate the craft. He merely decides where it is to put down. So it is today with the very largest organizations. The larger the enterprise, the easier it is to shape its patterns and destinies unknown to the occupants and owners." And he has owners in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And then another part of tetrad management. This is from the book Take the Day the Executives as Dropout. Came out in 1972, the quote is, "When war and market merge, all money transactions begin to drip blood." And money and market merge in the global theater. All money transactions begin to drip blood. That leads to the popularization of the Godfather syndrome and then the Sopranos.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody watches the Sopranos pretending that it's about the mafia, but it's actually about daily life.
Right, which leads back to this question we were considering a moment ago, which is the notion that if it's okay for, through like the National Security Act, for the tetrad managers to lie to the public and fabricate the consensus reality, based on the notion that we can't, that if we knew what was really going on, the fabric of society would come apart at the seams. But then we have to ask the next question, which concerned LaRouche and our founding fathers and all of us who are concerned with free speech and all the rest of it. You know, the power corrupts. So who are these guys, these tetrad managers? Are they mafioso people who do not have our best interest in mind collectively, or are they, or are they, as you suggested earlier, they do have our collective best interest in mind because our collective best interest is in alignment with their own best interest?
Yeah, they have their own best interest in mind, the mafias and tetrad managers, but it's within the training, cultural conditioning of industrial society and then an early information society, and they want to preserve the right of the individual to make a living any way he wants. So they objected to communism, which was a more tribal format where people worked for the state, and there was a supposed freedom of access to all the services, but no opportunities to stand out individually in the Western sense. So this is the Gutenberg meme that Mr. Rockefeller is preserving, and there are millions of people who would support that because that's their cultural conditioning. It's not based on their religion or their culture. It's based on the media effect of the literate environment, which creates a print-oriented, isolated individual. And this is seen as a good thing. It was seen 500 years ago as a good thing. It was a transitional, traumatic situation, but it became a shared value of preservation once people got used to the Gutenberg effect. Then that gets upset by the Marconi effect, the electronic 20th century. So that creates a crisis because more and more society is becoming actually communistic, software communism, as McLuhan called it.
Well, but at the same time, the android meme is precipitating us out as individuals.
And that's later. That's a later phase.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be when we get into Croker. But we're dealing with the phase just before that. But,
right.
You know, that's true what you're saying, but that's later. That's more complex. But we're just talking about the tetrad managers. Remember on my chart, the tetrad managers are obsolesced by the pentad managers, which is the android meme phase. So we're describing the 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s, and 70s of the tetrad management phase. Okay? And so you had the CIA aligning with mafia people. You know, a very good novelist who portrays this tetrad management from 1958 to 1968 is James Ellroy's novels. First one, American Tabloid, the second one called A Cold 6000, which goes from 1958 to 63 in the first volume, and then A Cold 6000 goes from 63, just after the Kennedy assassination, to just after the Robert Kennedy assassination in summer of 1968. So those show the liaison and merger and interpenetration of the FBI, the CIA, the White House, the Mafia, the drug dealers, the arms traders, the Klan, the Las Vegas, all these institutions that are forced to work very close with each other. As McLuhan said in one of his books, the modern corporation is made up of entities that are utterly unlike each other. Well, James Ellroy's books show that.
Well, that must have changed, though, because by the time we get to 9/11, everybody's saying 9/11 happened because these people aren't communicating with each other.
Well, that's a later android meme phase. Yeah, that's later. You're talking 30 years later. Why did we do all that? Where you were bringing up the UFO and feeling uncomfortable, and then you just brought up the mafias or something we were talking about before we go on to the next quote. Why did we get into that? Why do the tetrad managers feel justified in their attitudes?
Yeah, what I wanted to know is, can we trust them to have our best interest in mind? Is that in alignment with their own best interest? And I think the answer was, what phase are you talking about? Are we talking about the present phase, or are we talking about 40 years ago, or 20 years ago, or 10 years ago?
Yeah, and what culture and medium are you identifying yourself with?
Right.
there's a lot of people who are cynical and exploit the general cultural consensus. And so people would look at the head of the CIA who says he's preserving the right for America to conduct business without many restrictions around the world so that we can enjoy and continue to have our fabulous level of wealth. That then is critiqued by all kinds of things, and then you have to look at the whole oil, global oil structure, which is a major energy resource for keeping people watching television and keeping the society efficient enough to enjoy all that they get in their electronic entertainment. That's what are we invested in?
Right. Well, we know right now that Bush has taken a pounding. The whole administration is, everybody's saying, we told you so, you should never have gotten us involved in this mess, now what are we going to do? You know, it's just going from bad to worse every day. There's no solution to this. You did it to us, we didn't want you to do it. But you're saying that that might all actually be orchestrated and that Bush...
I would say you have to look at the new medium. I would say that the change in the makeup of Congress in November 2006 was due to the new environment of YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
New media came in 2005, and these media have pretty instant effects. And YouTube played a big role in the election. It was
why? Because it had a democratizing effect?
Yes, in the sense that people could tape that guy, George Allen. I think he was running in Virginia, who made